Welcome back to our exploration down the history of Mr. Andy Sacker, formidable mandolin player, singer, songwriter, what I'm most proud of is that we've been friends for almost 20 years. I can honestly say, never heard an ill word out of this man's mouth. Welcome back, Andy. So we're up to 75. You build your house in Vermont after becoming a bluegrass star in Atlanta, playing five shows a night, six nights a week.
That star was not very high in the sky. It was not very bright either. It was kind of smoky and clouded. Anyway, I forgot. I should have mentioned concerning Vermont. In the summer of 71 was when I first played a gig in Vermont.
Okay.
I mentioned that I came up in summers until we actually moved here. And I guess through Marshall, who I'd mentioned earlier, the banjo player, Marshall Friedland.
Who had been here a while.
Yeah, he'd been here quite a while. And he asked me if I would play a gig, and I said sure. And he said we're going to be playing with this guy named Danny Cohn, and it was for a music festival being held up at Bolton, right at the base lodge where the cable thing ends. And yeah, this was the summer of 71. And that was the summer that Alice and I came up from Chicago for the whole summer and spent it with Mark and Joanne. Mark and his wife had actually moved here by that time. They were already living here. So
in that ensemble, I know Danny plays both the guitar and the banjo, and Marshall plays the banjo. What was the lineup?
Yeah, Marshall played the banjo. Danny played guitar and me on the mandolin, and a guy named Cliff something, I forget his last name, an older man, played the string bass, played bass. It was a four-piece band. And the festival was a music festival. There was a jazz band, there was a rock band, there was a this and a that, and they thought they'd have a bluegrass band too. So we got together, did one little practice session with Danny. So it was the first time I'd met Danny Cohn, and realized that he was a powerhouse of a singer and a rhythm guitarist and a guitar player. And
a spark plug full of energy.
Yeah, yeah. Eight cylinders worth of spark plug.
Right.
Or 12 cylinders. So we did that gig, and there's a I've got a photograph this friend of mine who also from Chicago was here at the time hanging out with us, and he was a photographer, and he took this great photo of the juxtaposition on stage. Marshall's on the left, then me, and then Danny, and then Cliff, this old bass player, and Danny is looks like he's you know, his hair is short, and he's wearing a white shirt, and he's got a tie on. And then there's Marshall and I on the left, and we are the hippies. I had long hair, like this long.
Big mustache. I think that was in your mustachio days.
I had a big mustache, and Marshall had long hair. And
we'll try to find get a copy of that from you and post it along with this.
But that was my first gig in Vermont. And
you had fun.
Oh yeah, it was fun. Yeah, it was fun. And anyway, the first winter after we built our house was kind of dreadful. Neither Alice or I had jobs. We had spent basically all our money building our unconventional hippie house, and so it was hard, and I think our marriage was already headed to the finish line already. That had already, that process had begun before that. Anyway, that spring, I got in a band. We were forming a band. Marshall on banjo and me, Gary Barr on guitar, and Mike Yates on the bass. Mike Yates was an electric bass player, played with Coco in the Lonesome Road Band, if you remember, ever saw that. Mike was from East Montpelier. I think he grew up there. Great bass player, great singer, tenor singer, nice voice, good voice. And we called that band Shady Grove. So that was my first official band in Vermont. And we did mostly traditional stuff. Gary Barr, the guitarist, had lived in Vermont for quite a while. He grew up in somewhere in central New York State. And he was ran the post office at Goddard College. That was his gig. And then he met Marshall when Marshall was a student there. And they had a band, I think, with Gary's wife on the bass, and he and Marshall. Gary was a great guitar player and a first-rate lead singer, and who he knew the core bluegrass repertoire quite well. He knew Lester Flatt singing. He did a lot of Lester Flatt songs, and he did them really well. I don't know if Gary is still alive. I know he left Vermont a few decades ago, and I think he moved down to the Carolinas. So I think he might be passed on.
I'm shrugging, obviously, my memory, because Shady Grove was a band that evolved from that to a different ensemble, correct?
There was one personnel change later on. Gary had a drinking problem, serious problem, and every night we would play, he would get drunker and drunker as the evening went on, and by the last set, it was at the point where we didn't want to say anything to the microphone because he would say bad things.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if he decided to quit or I don't remember exactly how this happened, but he left. And we had played mostly in the Montpelier Barrie area, but we also played at least five or six times in Burlington at the Opry. Before Hunts, it was the Opry.
Can you take a few moments and just tell us all about the Opry? Because I went there a couple of times. I know our producer here has been there because he's old. But my brothers and sisters used to. That was the place to go for great music, and mostly traditional hillbilly music. I think Ricky Skaggs played there once.
Ricky? No, it was his band.
Creek, something Creek. We'll have our producer jump right on that.
it was the band where Ricky was quite young and the dobro player was Jerry Douglas.
Yeah, right.
Also quite young, like they were 20, 21 years old maybe.
But what was that scene like as a musician going and playing the Opry?
Oh, the Opry was good. It was a big bar. It was, if you knew Hunts and not the Opry, the Opry was just the first room of Hunts, where the door off the street, off of Main Street, you went down the steps and then in the door, and it was just that one. It was a one big rectangular shaped room. When it became Hunts a few years after that, '68, '69, when Yoram Sammets bought it, and he made it into Hunts, and he he added first one room size, well, and then a second room, that, and that was the final size of Hunt's big. Anyway, the Opry was, it was, I think the real name was the Yankee Pickin' Opry.
Okay.
Yankee Pickin'. And yeah, it was good. It was, you know, it was crowded. There were students there. It was, I think that was the apogee, the
crest.
Climax of the bluegrass.
Yeah, cause
fandom in
I've told the younger people that that there was a time in Burlington music history that at least one bar on any given night in Burlington had a bluegrass band playing in it back in the 70s.
Yeah, well, yeah. I was just talking to Dan Mahoney, who's you know, about a quarter of a mile from here.
Is he living here now?
He bought a summer home, and he and his wife just fixed it up.
We hope to have Dan on as well.
You should get him on, because he will give you the early Burlington music scene. I mean, he lived it.
Yeah. I mean, his sister, right, too, or sister-in-law? Sister.
I'm not sure. His whole family, they all sang.
She played bass in one of your bands, I think.
No.
What was her name?
No.
Anyways, we're off track. So, Opry, you guys played the Opry?
Yeah.
Five times.
I don't know how many times, but we played a few times. And that's where I met my second wife. That's where I met Betty. And it was in that place when I was playing with Shady Grove.
So, tell me about that. I'd love to hear how you guys met. If it's too personal, we can keep it out, but...
Well, I saw her, she was sitting at the bar, and I think, was what I remembered. I remember that we had different ideas of what happened, but I said, you smiled at me.
Mm.
And she said, oh, no, you smiled at me. And which would have been typical for Betty to say something like that. Anyway, that's where we met. And so that getting back to the music story, that band, we needed a new guitarist because Gary was too troublesome with his drinking right. problem. And I don't know how we found him or he found us, but this young, like 20-year-old, maybe 21, French kid was living in Burlington. His name was Francois Gaumeau. And he grew up in Nice. Wonderful, on the southern coast of France. And he played guitar quite well. He was all tied up in Tony Rice's playing style, and he could sing. If bluegrass with a strong French accent is is if you can picture hearing that, that's what it was. And so he became. He joined. He took Gary's place, and the most consequential gig that we had was it was a bluegrass festival, and again this was at Bolton. I'd mentioned playing there before in 71, so this would have been about 78, I guess, the summer of 78, I think, maybe 77. Let me think. 77 probably. When Francois was in the band, and we got ourselves added to the schedule. I almost think that we went up there and talked the promoter, and I don't remember who it was, into letting us play, and he did, and it was we came across really well there. and people really dug it. And somewhere I have the clipping written by somebody, one of the papers, and he said he said this was the high point of the day, was hearing Shady Grove. And obviously wasn't anybody who knew anything about music. No, I'm kidding. It was good. Francois would say to me with his, I don't want to make fun of his accent, but I can't help it. He'd say, "Andy, play Leave and Let Leave. Do Leave and Let Leave." It's a Bill Monroe song, Live and Let Live.
Right.
How about
in 75 or 76? Wasn't that consequential? The big Bluegrass Festival in Essex, you guys played at too?
That wasn't 75 or 6.
When was that?
That was about 79, I think, or maybe, I think that was 78 or 9. And that was with, I played that with my next band, with two of my next bands. That festival might have been later than you think. Because in the summer of 78, I got together, and I remember where this happened. It was at the Mahoney camp, Danny Mahoney's family camp on, what's the name of the road that goes, the beach, Thayer Beach. First camp, when you drive onto the gravel road and go to the Thayer Beach, that first camp there was there, the Mahoney family camp. And anyway, he had a picking party there, and we got together, Nancy Bevan, Lynn McSotta, me, Mahoney, and Gene White. And
wow,
we were just playing out. And Gene, I knew Gene from, because he had been the bass player in the Coco and the Lonesome Road Band. He played electric bass. And he was a violinist, but he only played fiddle. I played the Orange Blossom Special every night, every Coco and the Lonesome Band gig. Paul Miller would switch over to bass. And I remember Danny Mahoney said something like, when he listening to Nancy singing, he said, "Nancy, I think I want to go to Hollywood on your coattails." And so we started the band. We called that band Dealer's Choice. I'm not sure who chose that name. And that was a band. Nancy played guitar, wonderful singer.
Nancy Bevan, right?
Nancy grew up in Southern Virginia, near Norfolk, Virginia. Hampton Roads, Virginia is where she came from. And she was into bluegrass and country music, and people likened her to Emmylou Harris. And
she had a great voice.
She was a great singer. And Lynn McSotta,
who ended up becoming Lynn Mahoney.
Yes.
She married
Tim Mahoney.
Tim Mahoney, yes.
Danny's younger brother.
Yeah.
And Lynn played bass, solid bass player, pretty good guitar player too, and play like swing chords on the guitar. She's and a good singer. And that band maybe lasted 2 years, maybe. I loved playing with them. I loved singing with Lynn and Nancy. I sometimes had to hitch my pants up to get up to the notes that I needed to play, to sing, but I really loved singing with them. And I taught them a lot of bluegrass numbers that were fun to sing. And that band changed personnel. Mahoney left after about 4 months because he was in the House of Reps in Vermont. He was in the State House, and he... The session was starting, so he kind of flaked off for that, and then Gene left too, and so we got Roy Feldman to play fiddle. Roy from New Jersey, kind of mostly a Irish, strong, a big fan of Irish Celtic music, and Gordon Stone became our banjo player. He had quit Pine Island, or had left Pine Island.
So was there any? I know there was just so many great bands or ensembles that you guys all got together, but the one thing that I've been curious about is there was Dealer's Choice, there was Banjo Dan, there was Pine Island. Was there any even moderate competition for gigs, or was there just plenty of gigs for everybody and everybody was great friends and you just went at it and had a blast?
I don't remember any competition in those days. I never did any of the booking aspect. I didn't know people, didn't know local people,
How much were you playing? I mean, a couple times a week?
Not full time, I mean, but yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Did you have a day job?
Well, I did. I had a job in Barrie. The first job I got, non-music job, was the spring of 76. So this was right after we built our house in the summer of 75. And I got a job. It was a CETA job. CETA? CETA? It was a government-funded job. It was crappy pay. I probably got $2.50 an hour. And working at the library in Barrie, I put together the local history room and did a bunch of, interviewed about 30, 35 of Barrie residents to try to, kind of oral histories recorded on a portable cassette recorder.
Kind of like what we're doing now.
Lo-fi. No, this was really lo-fi.
So I think when
Dealer's Choice started, I decided to move here, and that so I left that job, and I moved here. And that was the second time in my life that I thought maybe I could play for a living, and it was a ridiculous notion that didn't work.
So Dealer Choice is going. You had mentioned to me that there might be you were a warm up act for another band. That it was an interesting story.
With Dealer's
Choice. Dealer's Choice. You had asked me to.
Oh. Well, now I'm going to have to remember what I was thinking of.
Well, we can come back to that. So.
Yeah.
I remember.
Yeah, one of the last gigs. Well, Dealer's Choice. We had personnel changes. The final banjo player, we hired this young guy who had just finished college down in Saratoga there. What's that? Skidmore? Is that Skidmore College? Skid Row? No, I think Skidmore. Maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, his name is Doug McElway, and his family lived in Washington. He grew up in the Washington suburbs. And he was a good banjo player. good banjo player, and sang, a good singer too. And he decided that he would join our band, move up here. Nancy Bevan and I drove down to Washington and picked him up. I also got to see my first nephew for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
My brother's first kid on that trip. And Doug McElway was very kind of clean cut, handsome. We used to call him the Clark Kent of bluegrass. And he was so handsome that he became an anchorman. I mean, as an adult, he was the anchorman of one of the network stations in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
And I think he's kind of retired now, but he's... But he still plays bluegrass. Still plays banjo, I think. Anyway, but we did play an interesting gig of opening up. We got asked to play this thing in Middlebury at the college, and it was the graduation weekend, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So we go down there and play, and there's a stage set up at the end of the soccer field. I think it's soccer fields. It's, you know, you can drive through the campus and then kind of head out, you know, towards the west, towards 22A, mm-hmm. I guess. And we were going to be the opening act for somebody else. And that somebody else turned out to be the Cars.
No.
And the Cars had just returned from playing in England, or a European tour, and they were back in the States, and they weren't quite as big as we remember the Cars became, but they were starting. And we played a set, and one of their sound men did our sound, and then they began playing, and we decided to stay and hear what they sounded like. And all I remember is there was hardly anybody there. I don't know who planned this event or what they had expected, but there was hardly anybody there to see them, or maybe nobody even knew who they were yet. But I think I'd heard of them. Anyway, all I remember is some burly guy, like I would call a burly frat boy type of guy,
mm-hmm.
walking right up in front of them and saying, "Hey, cut this punk shit and play some reggae." And he did it about four times. He'd just stand up and yell this thing. And because there were so few people, you heard every word he said. It was kind of a funny scene. That's all I remember about that day.
Now, I first probably met you... obviously, I first met you probably was during the Breakaway days. But I remember you worked at what used to be Boyd's Music that turned into a music store.
Calliope. That was
Calliope.
My store.
Yeah. And you owned it. Yeah. Half with...
Bobby Owen.
Yeah.
I didn't know
that. Yeah. And that was right on Main Street in Burlington.
Yeah. Yeah, that was 1989, I think.
So
I was only in that for just about 2 years.
So Andy Sacker, let's say that festival in Essex was 78. This is just my recollection. 79 to 81. The bluegrass scene, especially in Vermont, like, dried up. And I remember a story, I don't even know if it's true, that the Stanley Brothers were booked to play some show, and for some reason my memory was like an ice rink somewhere. and they got booed off the stage, and that was when bluegrass kind of died a little bit here in Burlington.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd never heard about that, but I think it was the crest of the bluegrass popularity was falling.
Replaced by disco or something? Or what was
I don't know.
So what happened to Andy Sacker?
Well, I just
after Dealer's Choice,
I kept playing the band. So the next band that I was in, and I wrote these down. They're in my
phone's up here. Oh,
anyway, I don't need to look. I remember. The next band was formed by Francois Gaumont, and Francois Gaumont, I should add that his godfather was Luis Vola, who was Django Reinhardt's bass player. He was Francois's godfather, and Francois eventually moved back to France, and he's been back there for a long time. He changed his last name to Vola to cash in a little bit, I guess, on that
godfather's name,
that history of the family. Anyway, so he started this band which was called Red Clover. Red Clover Bluegrass, the state flower of Vermont, state flower, the red clover, right? Mm-hmm.
I believe you're right.
Yeah, it is.
Can you dig into that, Mr. Producer?
You know, it is.
That was marijuana.
And this band was a good band. I mean, it was really good.
And what year was that?
I think it was 79. Okay. I'm guessing. And I think that maybe Dealer's Choice was still there, but there wasn't much work coming in. We were a dying band.
Mm-hmm.
And so Francois started this band. He was on guitar and me, and Mahoney, I'm pretty sure, playing dobro, and Gene, no, Gene playing fiddle? No, Gene was not playing fiddle. Doug McElway was playing banjo, this kid who had joined, and Clyde on bass. Clyde was living in Vermont now. We last left him when he was playing bass for my band, electric bass, with my band in Chicago when he was his first bluegrass experience. And Clyde had finished college at the U of C and moved out to the West. He was living in Northern California somewhere for about a year. And he was playing the dobro and started playing the string bass. And then Clyde got married to a woman he met out there, I think. She might have been a Californian. And her name was Linda. I think she was not a psychiatrist, but a something akin to that on a little lesser level, whatever. And they moved to West Virginia, and Clyde built a house down there, another hippie house, and he got in playing with a band called the Outdoor Plumbing Company. And they were West Virginia guys, and they were all Southern guys, and so he learned bluegrass, the real thing, the real Southern solid. He knew how to push a bluegrass band along on the bass, just push it, you know, playing that bass where you're almost
ahead
on
of
the
edge,
almost ahead of the beat, just driving it like crazy. And so the first time I played with him was when we got, I think, when we, the first time that this Red Clover band got together, and Clyde was like swallowing an energy pill. For me, it felt like, wow, this is so good. But unfortunately, that band didn't. I think we didn't play. I guess the playing opportunities were drying up.
Did you record anything with Dealer's Choice or Red Clover or
Dealer's Choice?
Shady
recorded
Grove?
About eight songs, I think, at the studio in Northfield.
Longfellow's place?
Yes.
Yeah.
Long Dick.
That's
what they used to call it. Yeah, where Pine Island,
Green
I think. Pine Island.
First album.
Mountain
Records.
They did
first
the first album.
Yeah.
Right. That's why we were there.
Simulated Gold 45 was recorded there.
Uh-huh. Simulated Gold.
So you recorded eight songs. Do you have any of those recordings?
I think I have it on a cassette player.
We would love to have some of that. Just
I don't
to put it on a CD for you.
Yeah,
and then we could tap into this.
You could do that.
I can tell you, living through those days, those bands were very influential. If anybody has ever heard Andy play with my band, one of the songs that they let me play a lead on is inspired by Francois Gomeau, which is Salt Creek, because every time you guys would let Francois Gomeau go, he would play an incredible rendition of Salt Creek.
He I think even more than that, he loved Huckleberry Hornpipe on the guitar,
yeah,
which he did really well.
Yeah.
Which is a great tune.
I'm not going to. We just still have time to go, but one of the things that I want, you can answer it now, and you can think about it as we go through the next few sets of this, is that really what blows me away is that all of you guys, when I think of you, I'm talking about you and Gordon and Dan Linder and Willie and Gusakoff and Jimmy Ryan and Nancy Bevan, all of you guys had something that said, we can do this, and it's different than, it's not Kentucky bluegrass. It's not Flatten Scruggs bluegrass. It was Vermont, for lack of a better way to say it, Vermont bluegrass. It was different. It had a different vibe to it, which was, to me as a young kid, almost addicting. It's what made me. You were talking about albums and bands that you listened to as a kid that instantly turned you on. You guys instantly made me want to play.
Well, Pine Island was probably the main purveyor of a kind of bluegrass that was bluegrass plus, you know, swinginess. They were what we would have to call a progressive bluegrass band, and at that time there were bands like that. There was the band down in New York State that was what was it called? Country Cooking. They did the same thing. They were, you know, their musical horizon was wider than just solid traditional bluegrass, or at least some of the members of the band. That they would lead off in a slightly different direction at times. You know, they'd play swing songs and the band that I was in Chicago, the late country string band, we would do stuff like that too. We would do the theme song from Casablanca. You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. The size of it. And
that's great.
Hoban, my friend Bob Hoban would sing that.
But that takes a... I know I'm talking way too much this set, but that takes a certain amount of confidence. It takes a certain amount of chutzpah to say, we're so good that we can take a song from any genre and make you tap your toe.
Well, yeah. I mean, not any genre, but...
I'm in awe of that.
Yeah, it's... I think that the country gentleman might have... They did things like that. I remember the first time I saw the country gentleman in person, which was at the Fincastle, at the Carlton Haney's Festival, either the first year or the second year, I forget which one. And they, in the middle of one of their sets, John Duffy says, Eddie Adcock, their banjo player, Eddie took his banjo with him to the movie theater, and folks weren't happy about that, but he learned the theme song from the movie, so and the movie was Exodus. Dung, 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 dung. And Adcock did a bluegrass version of Exodus that was quite good.
He was an amazing banjo player.
Yeah, he was great.
Talk about non-traditional, earth-changing banjo.
Yeah, he had his own ideas, yeah. Yeah, he was great. Yeah. And that was part of the reason why I thought they were so good. But they did some stuff that was also...
So did you guys push each other? I mean, I know you said nobody was competitive, but if somebody did something cool, did another band go, man, that's cool. We should do something similar. Was there that drive?
If you hear something that you like that's a little different, you don't want to say you're going to just copy it, but I don't know. That's part of the process of learning and growing, and I'm not the greatest about that, but I have done a lot of material that I have put together for bands has been songs from outside of the bluegrass world.
Okay, and we're gonna tie this up with a last question or two, and it really kind of comes back to your songwriting. One of my favorite songs that you wrote was the Sodbusters Blues, which we'll play you a little sample here. And this song just. I remember when you first played it, I remember hearing, geez, is this about Andy and his brother? And is this a conversation that they're having back and forth? And you're like, no way, I'm staying here in Vermont. Screw you. No matter how tough it is, I'm here. So could you tell me a little bit about the Sodbusters Blues before we leave?
It's Sodbuster Blues. Leave the... S off that.
Yeah.
I wrote that when I was really pretty young. I was about 22 or 3, maybe. And I, to the best of my memory, I wrote it when I was had a fever, and I was in bed with a fever, and sort of had the whole song kind of together, and I know I borrowed from at least one movie one of the lines.
Which one was that?
I'm not going to tell you.
Legal reason.
I think it's in the last verse. I don't know. It's the second or third verse. It was from a Western, a movie made in maybe in the 50s. I used to love watching old movies. Mm-hmm. And anyway, yeah, it was just, I don't know. It was when the Lake Country String Band, we were contacted in about 1971 by Norman Dayron. Norman Dayron was a grad student at the University of Chicago. Two of the guys in our band were grad students at the university. There were three of our guys in our band because I forgot that there was another, a second guitar and a tenor singer joined our band. Pete McGraw was his name. He just died about two years ago. I'm sad. And anyway, this guy Norman Dayron was a grad student, and he somehow became Howling Wolf's producer. He produced albums for Chess Records, and he produced Howling Wolf and had done like two albums. He also produced an album called Fathers and Sons, and it was the Chicago blues, the real Chicago blues players like Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, and how they taught a new generation of, well, turned out to be mostly all white guys, white kids, taught them how to play the blues,
right?
Just by, because, you know, it was not unlike Bill Monroe bluegrass to the northern urban kids. Southern blues moved to the city and became electric, and then another generation took up that kind of playing. So Norman Dayron, he'd heard our band, he'd heard Lake Country String Band, and he wanted to produce an album. And so, sure, he said, great, we'll do it. And he had us, because he worked at Chess, because he did his producing at Chess Records, which was still down at whatever it was, 2121 South Michigan Avenue.
That's an amazing.
Just like
memory.
The song. Well, there's a song. The Rolling Stones did it. 2121 South Michigan, I think, is the name of it. Anyway, so he had a time when nobody was using the studio because it was free.
Mm-hmm.
So at midnight, we arrived at the Chess Records in Studio A, great big room, like 40 by 40 feet or whatever, big room, and with booth up there, glass windows just like you'd see in a movie.
Yeah.
And we did two nights. We came in late at night and did about six songs, and he took it. When it was done, he took it, got an appointment to see the president of Mercury Records. Mercury was Chicago, was in Chicago. Mercury was a big label, and so we sat in the office of the president of Mercury Records, and his head of A&R was there, and we listened to our recording, which was pretty rough, I think, and they said, "Well, no, we're not sure about this." They passed on it, in other words. And in fact, the A&R guy said, when he heard a mandolin solo, he said, "Is that a ukulele?"
Oh my gosh!
So. But they had released bluegrass in the past. I think the Stanley Brothers did one or two albums on Mercury. And anyway,
so I'd bust your blues.
So that's when I was in that band. That's when I was teaching. That's when I was teaching school.
So was that song on that demo?
Yeah.
No kidding.
But it was the earliest that recording. Sounds quite well. It's the same song, but it's done differently than you know it and that I know it now. Huh. When I started doing it with Breakaway, I guess it was with Breakaway that it became what it is. Yeah. What you know.
So that's a great segue. We're going to stop right there. We have a whole plethora of stories left with the Breakaway years and post Breakaway years for Mr. Andy Sacker. Thank you so much, and we'll see you the next set, and have a good evening.